Meditation practice, do whatever you wish in these 10 minutes. You don't have to do what I'm talking about. So let's talk a little about mindfulness and then we'll sit. Mindfulness can be looked at as having three aspects or three benefits: peace, presence, and perspective. Peace. If you do nothing else when you practice mindfulness, relax, soften, open, let go of tension. So if there's no other benefit than that, you get the enormous benefit of releasing all the stuff that you've been carrying on all the levels that you've been carrying. And a very helpful way to release is to pay attention to your breathing, because it's soothing and rhythmic. So if you do nothing else, breathe, soften, open, relax. Let your boundaries widen. That's the peace part. And that's underneath almost all of the physiological benefits that people are learning about day after day, it seems like. In other words, it's good for a lot of physical things because you release the stress and tension that you're habitually under, and that allows your cardiovascular system and your immune system to recover. Second, I'm going to talk about presence. Third, when you pay attention to your breathing, you can't stay lost in thought because you have the thought, I have to pay attention to my breathing. You find your breathing, it's like taking a step back from this stuff. And after a while, well, then you get sucked in again, and then you take a step back. And after a while, you're able to remain with your breathing and notice thoughts, feelings, and sensations. So the you that you have been formerly in your life and that you generally think you are turns out to be something that is more superficial than the you that you really are. We're going to look neuropsychologically at that, neurophysiologically at that pretty quickly today. But the idea is, when you find your breathing, you take a step back, and you have perspective on your thoughts, your feelings, and your sensations. It's not that you can necessarily change them, but you're not governed by them. You become the sky, and that's just the weather. We've talked about that a whole lot. You can't make that happen by thinking about it. If you think, I'm going to get perspective, you're just lost in another kind of thought. You have to shift your attention to something other than thought in order to make this happen. And if you shift your attention to your breathing over and over again, this perspective will spontaneously emerge. It's not something you do. It's just something that happens. Presence, which we haven't talked about a tremendous amount. Generally, don't throw bricks at me. I've talked to so many people about this recently. I taught three different groups mindfulness this week alone that I probably have told you this a lot. But the psychological present is supposedly about 3 seconds long for reasons which I have no idea why they said 3 seconds long. I think it has to do with the fact if I look at Robert, I can look at him for about 3 seconds before my mind goes somewhere else. Our minds are like wild horses and they go wherever they go. So the psychological present is supposedly 3 seconds long, and that those of you who remember the Daniel Kahneman talk that we saw, he's a Nobel Prize winner, so I take his word for it. He also calculated that in an 80-year life, there are about 600 million 3-second present moments. And it is possible to never be there for any of them. If you are lost in thought, you are not really present. You think you are present, and you fuzzily see the world, but you are abstracted from the world in a construction of the world, in an interpretation of the world. If you find your breathing, and you soften it open, you just keep coming back to your breathing. You come out of the bubble into actually, hello there, everybody. It's been a hell of a morning. I've been lost in that bubble. Here we are. It is this moment. Your feet are on the ground. Your backside is in the chair. Your breathing is happening. The air is cool. There may be thoughts in your head, maybe not. That's called presence. You want to every once in a while in your life touch down on the earth, you know, and come into presence. So that after a while you have the option of being or here. And more and more, the metaphor that you've heard everything that I'm saying before, forgive me, I'm just getting everybody on board. The metaphor is, we're so used to being lost in thought that it's, when we try to be present, it's very difficult. We sit and we meditate and it's hard for 10 minutes and we go, oh, thank God, 10 minutes is over. And that's called crawling, okay? Being lost in thought is crawling. It's hard. It hurts your knees and it's hard. And people that learn to be present go, it's like walking. It's so much easier than crawling. But when you're learning, when the little kid is learning to walk, it's very hard. The little kid flops down, and if he wasn't encouraged, he wouldn't ever learn to walk. It would just keep crawling. So with practice, you have the option of crawling or walking at any moment in your life. It's really nice to walk most of the moments in your life, or at least some of them. So becoming present, this isn't an idea. This is an experience. And there's a dramatic difference between what I'm doing now, which is lost in thought, and what I'm doing now, which is being here with you, being present. Makes a difference in everything. Makes a difference in the way you connect with people. So, three levels of instruction about mindfulness today. By the way, we'll spend less and less time on the meditation instruction, more and more time didactically. But this is so crucial that I took time last week, and I'll take this much time this week to do this. But this is it. This is extraordinary. It will be the normal thing that we do. So three levels of instruction about mindfulness. Level one, if you do nothing else in these 10 minutes, breathe, soften, open, relax. So at least you let go of some of the tension that has been incorporated in your system. And you let yourself recover. You let yourself heal. First level, peace. Second level, if you keep coming back to your breathing, over and over again, every time you get lost in thought, after a while you'll hear and see your thoughts, you'll feel your feelings, you'll notice your sensations, you'll be present, you'll have perspective on what's happening. You'll be the sky, that will be the weather. Third, most sophisticated level at this point has to do with presence. There's the past, there's the future. Mostly we think about the past and the future. If you could monitor your thoughts, they would be about what happened and what's going to happen. The past and the anticipated past, is what they said. There are two levels to presence. One level to presence is thinking about the present as opposed to thinking about the past and the future. So I am standing here right now, my feet are on the floor, I'm looking at the people in the class. You know, that's thoughts about the present. At least I'm not thinking about the traffic getting here and what I have to do after. You know, at least I've got my thoughts on the present. But there's a deeper level of it. The deeper level of being present is noticing what is occurring, thoughts, feelings, and sensations, right at this moment, balancing on this moment. And the way I like to do it, excuse me for this, the way I like to do it is I like to shrink the timeline so that when I'm first sitting, the present is around now. And then as my consciousness gets sharper and sharper, I narrow the timeline. So now I'm looking at what's happening right at this instant. And the next instant, there's something else happening. And those instants keep getting so that when I'm really sharp and aware, I'm aware of every. It's like there's no future and no past and no future. Something that happens fades instantly, and the next thing is in its place. And if you try that, you'll have an extraordinary experience. So maybe some of you will try that in just 10 minutes, which is Just breathe, relax, find your breathing. Open your awareness to the to have perspective on things, and then say, what's happening right this instant? Right this instant. Right this instant. Make that instant smaller and smaller. Okay? That's the advanced instruction for today. Okay, let's sit. Okay, we'll sit for 10 minutes. One last instruction, which is don't try. Okay, this is, don't make this arduous. This is letting go. And the adjustment in your awareness will kind of happen by itself. This is not a question of trying to do anything. It's a question of releasing, releasing, releasing. Opening, opening, opening. Paying attention because attention is there.
That's better. Because this is called consciousness class, I thought we would tackle the hard problem a little bit today. The hard problem being, what is consciousness? How does this give rise to this give rise to this? I'm going to have some help to do this myself.
Use the best in the world to help us. But I need to first set up the groundwork here for just a moment.
You need to move the piano?
What? No, I don't need anything moved. Thank you. There are two models of consciousness that are the predominant models of consciousness. The first one is the science model, or orthodox science model, I should say. Consciousness is a product of brain function. Somehow the incredibly intricate structure of our brains gives rise to our life experience. How that happens, no one knows. That's really the hard problem in science, how the brain gives rise to mind. But the guy who probably knows most, well, maybe Dan Siegel knows a lot, the guy that came to Mind Supermind a few years ago, if you remember. But the guy we're going to see certainly knows a lot. He's going to be talking from the orthodox science perspective about how the brain generates mind. However, there's an alternative perspective, which is the frontier science, let's call it, perspective. And this perspective is the perspective that Rick Hansen, the guy that wrote Buddha's Brain, and his co-worker and teacher Dan Siegel, the guy that I just told you about, who wrote Mind Sight, for example, that what they talk about, and it's this perspective. There is some larger awareness which issues forth the physical world. Okay? You can call this original mind, universal mind, God, whatever you want to talk about. But this basic fact of being issues forth the material world, which then generates our individual consciousness. This perspective tries to unify science and spirituality. The question is whether this perspective in people like Hansen and Siegel is based on their actual experience or whether it's based on what they learned when they were little about the nature of the world and religion. In other words, are they carrying forth into their current life a prejudice from early learning? Or do they know something actual at this point? Have they had mystic experiences? And I don't know, because they're not here, so I can't ask them. There is one addition to this perspective that I want to make, which is this. That is, each of our individual experiences may influence the source level. That is, there are two possibilities for this level. One is it's in the collective unconscious. And each of our individual experiences in life adds into the collective unconscious. The other possibility is each of our individual experiences actually affects the generative force. So we're kind of all we're all levels of God, we're all parts of God, and each of our experience is informing the God level. Everything that you're going to hear today doesn't, which is this perspective, doesn't preclude this perspective. You've heard me say this before. This perspective says, your mind isn't there except when it's made by your brain. This perspective says your brain is a television set, and it receives some larger kind of consciousness, transduces it, that changes its form, into your individual consciousness. And what the guy is going to say today, it is entirely compatible with the idea that your brain is a television receiver. He's going to be looking inside the brain, seeing what parts of it have to do with consciousness. And one of those parts, the most fundamental part, may generate consciousness, or it may receive and transduce consciousness. So this is the framework, the basic framework that we're setting up. Questions? Is it clear? It's pretty straightforward. Abraham?
When you're saying that the first part is like the brain generates the thoughts or the consciousness, and then the second part it receives it, is that the difference between them? Or?
The brain makes the thoughts in this one. In this one, the brain makes our individual thoughts, but consciousness comes from beyond the brain, into the brain, and then the brain generates our individual thoughts.
Okay. Where does it come from? Where does it come from in that model? So that
in this model? It depends on what your spiritual background is. If you're Zen, it's original mind. If you're more orthodoxly religious, it's God. It's, if you're Ken Wilber, it's source level. It depends on what. It's universal mind if you're Stan Grof. I mean, they're just different names for the same idea, that there's something more fundamental than this and this. David?
I like Rodney Smith's interpretation. He said, the mind is a thought believing.
Is it a thought?
Your mind is a thought believing, yes.
I can't hear
it.
Can you hear the sentence?
Thought belief.
A thought belief.
A thought believe.
Believe. Your mind is a thought belief. All right. Okay, so now what we're going to do is something that Len.
Smith, could you just for a moment talk about the differences in the kinds of proofs for the existence of each of these two kinds of consciousness?
This proof we're going to see, this one is real clear because science is investigating this. Knock you on the head, your consciousness goes away. You know, put alcohol in, your consciousness goes like this. So this one says, you know, this obviously the brain is generating because you can knock it. If the brain doesn't work, consciousness isn't there. You know, or if the brain is altered, consciousness is altered. The proof would have to be on a different level than the physical plane for this. There'll be a different level of proof. To answer the question seriously, people who have had mystic experiences, direct experience of another level of things, Say, that's the proof. If you don't have that level of experience, there's no way you're going to be able to know about that level of experience. You're going to keep trying to reduce it to this level of experience. Once you've had that experience, you see that there's something else that generates this, and it's very clear to you, and it's clear to everybody else throughout history who's ever had this experience. You can read all the spiritual literature, and they all say the same thing in different words. That there's something that, you know, but if your eyes aren't open at that level, at Plato's level of original forms, right? Or at the level of not shadows on the wall that we're all watching, but going out of the cave and seeing that there's actual sunlight out there. I mean, people have said this throughout history. But if you don't have that experience, it's just a theory. Yeah. So the proof is in the pudding. It's in the actual experience. Michael, and then we have to see this, because otherwise it's just... Michael.
In his book, Mindsight, Daniel Siegel defines mind as a process that is embodied and relational that regulates the flow of energy and information.
Yeah. And so it's a process that is embodied and relational to the world that regulates the flow of energy and information. The question is, what is this energy and information? You know, Deepak Chopra said, you're patterned by a field of energy and information. What is the nature of this field? Is it electrical? No, it's some kind of energy at a different level. Okay, information at a more basic level. All right. But again, I want to show you, I want to go from the philosophic to the neuroscience level. And I'm going to show you something that I actually showed you before, which I've never done before. It's repeated... I think once many years ago I repeated a TED talk that we saw, or a video we saw. But I saw this again the other night, and I thought, I have to illuminate it for you. I have to guide you through it. So we're going to listen to Antonio Damasio again. And he's going to talk about what consciousness is from a neuroscience point of view. And, well, you'll see. Okay. And I will stop frequently to say, look, here's what he's saying, here's what he's saying, here's what he's saying, here's what he's saying. So this is as best we know in neuroscience about why you are what consciousness is, why you are conscious, and where it comes from. So we need everything darkened. Make it as dark as we can, because the projection here isn't ideal. So we'll be good enough.
We should talk about the wonder and the mystery of conscious minds. The wonder is about the fact that we all woke up this morning and we had with it the amazing return of our conscious mind. We recovered minds with a complete sense of self and a complete sense of our own existence. And we hardly ever pause to consider this wonder. We should, in fact, because without having this possibility of conscious minds, we would have no knowledge whatsoever about our humanity, we would have no knowledge whatsoever about the world. We would have no pains, but also no joys, we would have no access to love or to the ability to create. And of course, Scott Fitzgerald said famously that he who invented consciousness would have a lot to be blamed for, but he also forgot that without consciousness he would have no access to true happiness and even to the possibility of transcendence. so much for the wonder, not for the mystery. This is a mystery that has really been extremely hard to elucidate, all the way back into early philosophy, and certainly throughout the history of neuroscience. This has been one mystery that has always resisted elucidation, has caused major controversies, and there are actually many people that think that we should not even touch it, we should just leave it alone, it's not to be solved. I don't believe that, and I think the situation is changing. It would be ridiculous to claim.
Okay, so I need to know, I'm sorry, I need to take it from full screen, because I need to know if you can hear.
Yes.
Yes, good, that's what I needed, because it's a little fuzzy up here. Okay? I will have to toggle between full screen and not full screen when I want to stop it to comment, which I will do at frequent points. Okay? So let's go back to play, and then I'll go to full screen again.
That we know how we make consciousness ridiculous to claim, that we know how we make consciousness in our brains, that we certainly can begin to approach the question, and we can begin to see the shape of a solution. And one more, we have imaging technologies that now allow us to go inside the human brain and be able to do, for example, what you're seeing right now. These are images that come from Hannah Demasi's lab and would show you in a living brain the reconstruction of that brain. And this is a person who is alive. This is not a person that is being studied at autopsy. And even more, and this is something that one could be really amazed about, is what I'm going to show you next, which is going underneath the surface of the brain and actually looking in the living brain at real connections, real pathways. So all of the real connections, real pathways. So all of those colored line fibers that join cell bodies to synapses, and I'm sorry to disappoint you, they don't come in color, but at any rate, they are there, the colors are the codes for the direction, for whether it is back to front or for the direction. At any rate, what is consciousness?
Okay, so I need to, since he talked about the brain, I need to just tell you very quickly, you've heard me say this before, there are 100 billion nerve cells in your brain, neurons. Actually, 86 billion is the current estimate, but 100 billion is useful for calculation. About 100 billion neurons, on the average, each connected to about 5,000 other neurons, which would make for 500 trillion connections, but actually the statistic you see is about 1 quadrillion connections in the brain. It's remarkably complicated, and you're using a lot of it at any given time. But it's even more complicated than that. There are about 10 times as many glial cells in the brain as there are neurons, and it's turning out that glial cells aren't just glue. They actually have some information transmission capability, so it may be that our understanding of the brain will open up as we learn more about glial cells. So it's an incredibly complicated structure, and the attempt is being made to map this. So what you saw, these fibers, they're axonal, they're parts of the neuron that are going in various places. But what we're trying to do now is map all the connections. That's called connectome. And that will be a prodigious job. And of course, it's a never finished job because the connections are constantly being made, strengthened, weakened, and eliminated. But there are huge strides in looking inside the brain, in brain imaging and brain mapping. And that's what's made a renaissance in neuroscience. We know more about the way the brain works than we used to. But this is just a preamble. We're getting to the good stuff.
What is the conscious mind? And we could take a very simple view and mind. And we could take a very simple view and say, well, it is that which we lose when we fall into deep sleep, and it is what we regain when we recover from sleep or from anesthesia. But what is exactly that stuff that we lose under anesthesia or when we are in deep, dreamless sleep? Well, first of all, it is a mind, which is a flow of mental images. And, of course, consider images that can be sensory patterns, visual, such as you're having right now in relation to to the stage in me, or auditory images as you're having now in relation to my words. That flow of mental images is mind. But there is something else that we're all experiencing in this room. We are not passive exhibitors of visual or auditory or tactile images. We have selves. We have a me that is automatically present in our minds right now. We own our minds, and we have a sense that it's every one of us that is experiencing this, not the person who is sitting next to you. So in order to have a conscious mind, you have a self within the conscious mind. So the conscious mind is a mind with a self in. The self introduces a subjective perspective in the mind, and we are only fully conscious when self comes to mind. So what we need to know to even address this mystery is...
Okay, so far what he said is... Well, you can probably see it, but I want to relate to this because it's going to have some implications. Okay. So what he said so far is mind is a flow of mental images. They may be verbal, they may be visual, they may have some other form. They're a flow of experiences, and we have a perspective that we call me on that flow of experiences. So far he's set up those two components of consciousness.
And that's what goes away when you're mindful in this meditation?
No, we're going to get there. We're going to get there. It's... Okay.
Number one, how minds are put together in the brain, and number two, how cells are constructed. Now, the first part, the first problem is relatively easy. It's not easy at all, but it is something that has been approached gradually in order to construct with our skin in relation to an object that we palpate. Now, to bring home the point of how close it is, the relationship between the grid of neurons and the topographical arrangement of the activity of the neurons and our mental experience, I'm going to tell you a personal.
It's skipped.
Lit or not.
Yeah, so yeah. This is, unfortunately, we have, this is some kind of bad connection. We have to know.
It is that which we lose when we fall into deep sleep without dreams, or when we go under anesthesia, and it is what we regain when we recover from sleep or from anesthesia. But what is exactly that stuff that we lose under anesthesia or when we are in deep dreamless sleep? Well, first of all, it is a mind, which is a flow of mental images. And of course, consider images that can be sensory patterns, visual, such as you're having right now in relation to the stage and me, or auditory images as you're having now in relation to my words. That flow of mental images is mind. But there is something else that we're all experiencing in this room. We are not passive exhibitors of visual or auditory or tactile images. We have selves. We have a me that is automatically present in our minds right now. We own our minds, and we have a sense that it's every one of us that is experiencing this, not the person who is sitting next to you. So in order to have a conscious mind, you have a self within the conscious mind. So a conscious mind is a mind with a self in it. The self introduces a subjective perspective in the mind, and we are only fully conscious when self comes to mind. So what we need to know to even address this mystery is, number one, how minds are put together in the brain, and number two, how cells are constructed. Now, the first part, the first problem, is relatively easy. It's not easy at all, but it is something that has been approached gradually in neuroscience. And it's quite clear that in order to make minds, we need to construct neural maps. So imagine a grid like the one I'm showing you right now. And now imagine within that grid, that two-dimensional sheath, imagine neurons, and picture, if you will, a billboard, a digital billboard, where you have elements that can be either lit or not. And depending on how you create the pattern of lighting or not lighting the digital elements, or for that matter, the neurons in the sheath, you're going to be able to construct a map. This is, of course, a visual map that I'm showing you, but this applies to any kind of map, auditory, for example, in relation to sound frequencies, or to the maps that we construct with our skin in relation to an object that we palpate. Now, to bring home the point of how close it is, the relationship between the grid of the activity of the neurons and our mental experience, I'm going to tell you a personal story. So, if I cover my left eye, I'm talking about me personally, not all of you. If I cover my left eye, I look at the grid pretty much like the one I'm showing you. Everything is nice and fine and perpendicular. But some time ago, I discovered that if I cover my left eye, instead, what I get is this. I look at the grid, and I see a warping at the edge of my central left field. Very odd, I've analyzed this for a while, but some time ago, through the help of an ophthalmologist colleague of mine, Carmen Pugliafito, who developed a laser scanner of the retina, I found out the following. If I scan my retina through the horizontal plane that you see there in the little corner, what I get is the following. On the right side, my retina is perfectly symmetrical. You see the going down towards the fovea, where the optic nerve begins, but on my left retina, there is a bump, which is marked there by the red arrow, and it corresponds to a little cyst that is located below. And that is exactly what causes the warping of my visual image. So just think of this. You have a grid of neurons, and now you have a plain mechanical change in the position of the grid, and you get a warping of your mental experience. So this is how close your mental experience and the activity of the neurons in the retina, which is a part of the brain located in the eyeball, or for that matter, a sheath of visual cortex. So from the retina, you go on to visual cortex, and of course the brain adds on a lot of information to what is going on in the signals that come from the retina, lens of what I call image-making regions in the brain. You have the green, for example, that corresponds to tactile information.
Okay, these are areas in the brain where there are mental maps. The neurons make like a billboard. In the back, this is the occipital, at the back of the brain, the occipital cortex, that's where the visual maps are primarily made. This blue area is in the temporal lobes. It's the auditory cortex. It's where maps of sound are made by patterns of neurons, by patterns of neuronal activity. The green area here is the somatosensory cortex. It's where touch information from your body comes in to the area in the parietal lobe at the top of your brain. And some of you remember from introductory psychology, there's a homunculus. There's a kind of a little person that is mapped out, but it's a distorted person because we have a lot more sensory receptors, for example, in our mouths than we do in our rear ends. So there's a big mouth and a little rear end mapped on this somatosensory cortex. The point is, your life experience comes in through your various senses, and it's mapped like a map, like on in various areas of your brain, and that's what produces inside your head the picture that your sense organs are giving you. That's pretty, for most of us, this is nothing new. This is just reviewed so far. Just the brain is reconstructing using these neurons, using these mental maps, what's out there. What you're aware of right now is inside your brain a reconstruction of what comes in through your senses. Except if you believe Rupert Sheldrake, who says that you're projecting back out, but that's another thing. So I'm going to leave it not full screen for a little while because I'm going to be stopping it a bunch.
A little more volume here.
or the blue that corresponds to auditory information, and something else that happens in information. And something else that happens is that those image-making regions where you have a plotting of all these neural maps can then provide signals to this ocean of purple that you see around, which is association cortex, where you can make records of what went on in those islands of image making. And the great beauty is that you can then go from memory out of those association cortices and produce back images in the very same regions that have perception. So think about how wonderfully convenient and lazy the brain is. So it provides certain areas for perception and image making, and those are exactly the same that are going to be used for image making when we recall information. So far, the mystery of the conscious mind is diminishing a little bit because we have a general sense of how we make these images. But what about the self? The self is really the elusive problem. And for a long time, people did not even want to touch it, and because they said, how can you have this sort of reference point, this stability that is required to maintain the continuity of cells day after day? And I thought about a solution to this problem. It's the following. We generate brain maps of the body's interior and use them as the reference for all other maps. So let me tell you just a little bit about how I came to this. I came to this because if you're going to have a reference that we know as self, the me, the I in our own processing, we need to have something that is stable, something that does not deviate much from day to day. Well, it so happens that we have a singular body. We have one body, not two, not three. And so that, to begin, there's just one reference point, which is the body. But then, of course, the body has many parts, and things grow at different rates and have different sizes in different people. However, not so with the interior. The things that have to do with what is known as our internal milieu, for example, the whole management of the chemistries within our body, are in fact extremely maintained day after day for one very good reason. If you deviate too much in the parameters that are close to the midline of that life-permitting survival range, you go into disease or death. So we have an inbuilt system within our own lives that ensures some kind of continuity. I like to call it an almost infinite sameness from day to day. Because if you don't have that sameness physiologically, you're going to be sick or you're going to die. So that's one more element for this continuity. And the final thing is that there is a very tight coupling between the regulation of our body within the brain and the body itself, unlike any other coupling. So, for example, I'm making images of you, but there's no physiological bond between the images I have of you as an audience and my brain. However, there's a close, permanently maintained bond between the body regulating parts of my brain and my own body. So here's how it looks. Look at the region there. There's the brainstem in between the cerebral cortex and the spinal cord. And it is within that region that I'm going to highlight now that we have this housing of all the...
Okay, wait, I got to pause for a minute. What he's saying is the experience of the constant you, of me watching this, of me being me, having these experiences, that comes from the fact that there's a constant perspective, that I'm always carrying around my perspective no matter what my experience is. No matter if I'm happy or unhappy, I'm still me having that experience. Where does that me come from? It comes from the brain constantly monitoring the inside of the body, the functioning of the body and adjusting it, you know, so that you don't become too hot or too cold, your blood pressure stays the way it should be, your blood sugar level stays, all these things are regulated constantly by the brain. And that consistency gives you a consistent sense of one thing, you know, a consistent stability in which all this change that you call experience happens. So the question is, where in the brain does this constancy arise? Where in the brain is the self? Now, we're going to go beyond this, by the way. We're not going to get stuck, stay stuck in the brain, but we have to understand this before we can go further. So now he's going to show us where your self is in your brain. Your sense of me having these experiences. So he's in the brain stem, which is just above the spinal cord, just below the major stuff in the brain. It's the if there are three parts of the brain, the brain stem, the limbic system, and the cerebral cortex, the brain stem is here, and that's where he is.
Life regulation devices of a body. This is so specific that, for example, if you look at the part that is covered in red in the upper part of the brain stem, if you damage that as a result of a stroke, for example, what you get is coma or vegetative state, which is the state, of course, in which your mind disappears, your consciousness disappears. And what happens then actually is that you lose the grounding of the self, you have no longer access to any feeling of your own existence, and in fact there can be images going on being formed in the cerebral cortex, except you don't know they're there. You have in effect lost consciousness when you have damage to that red section of the brain stem. But if you consider the green part of the brain stem, nothing like that happens. It is that specific. So in that green component of the brain stem, if you damage it, and often it happens, what you get is complete paralysis, but your conscious mind is maintained. You feel, you know, you have a fully conscious mind that you can report very indirectly. It is a horrific condition, you don't want to see it, and people are in fact imprisoned within their own bodies, but they do have a mind. There was a very interesting film, one of the rare good films done about a situation like this, by Julian Schnabel some years ago, about a patient that was in that condition. So,
anybody remember what the name of that film was? What was the name of it? Bell Jar and the Butterfly?
Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Okay. So what he said is, in this particular region of the brain stem, the back of it, if you damage that region, no self. If you damage the front of it, self, but no body. Okay, so you can't communicate with your body. So it seems as though that region of the brainstem is where the self is located, not up here where you're thinking. And in a minute, I will show you the implication of that. That's really the most important thing.
Now I'm going to show you a picture. I promise not to say anything about this, except this is to frighten you. It's just to tell you that in that red section of the brainstem, there are, to make it simple, all those little squares that correspond to modules that actually make brain maps of different aspects of our interior, different aspects of our body. They are exquisitely topographic, and they are exquisitely interconnected in a recursive pattern. And it is out of this, and out of this tight coupling between the brainstem and the body, that I believe, and I could be wrong, but I don't think I am, that you generate this mapping of the body that provides the grounding for the self, and that comes in the form of feelings. Primordial feelings, by the way. So what is the picture that we get here? Look at cerebral cortex, look at brainstem, look at body, and you get a picture of the interconnectivity in which you have the brainstem providing the grounding for the self in a very tight interconnection with the body, and you have the cerebral cortex providing the great spectacle of our minds with the profusion of images that are, in fact, the contents of our minds. And
can I have a light for 1 second? Somebody get it? Just here so you can see. What he just told you is this is in the brainstem. Okay, the basic awareness is in the brainstem, and it can be aware of stuff happening up here. That's your thoughts. Okay, so you can a friend of mine and I investigated this way before Damasio talked. And we sat and we said, where is this awareness coming from? And both of us independently came to the same conclusion. The awareness comes from here. We can feel it coming from here to, and up above it is, you probably had that experience. Your thoughts are above what you're watching them from below them. But your body is below you where you're watching. And where your body is where your feelings are and where your sensations are. So this and this is the downward arrows from the brain stem. This is the upward arrow. So neurophysiologically, it's verifying this experiential distinction that we make when we're mindful. There's more.
We normally pay most attention to, as we should, because that's really the film that is rolling in our minds. But look at the errors. They're not there for looks. They're there because there's this very close interaction. You cannot have a conscious mind if you don't have the interaction between cerebral cortex and brainstem. You cannot have a conscious mind if you don't have the interaction between the brainstem and the body. Another thing that is interesting is that the brainstem that we have is shared with a variety of other species. So throughout vertebrates, the design of the brainstem is very similar to ours, which is one of the reasons why I think those other species have conscious minds like we do, except that they're not as rich as ours because they don't have a cerebral cortex like we do. That's where the difference is, and I strongly disagree with the idea that consciousness should be considered as the great product of the cerebral cortex. Only the wealth of our minds is, not the very fact that we have a self that we can refer to our own existence and that we have any sense of person. Now, there are three levels of self to consider, the proto, the core, and the autobiographical. The first two...
He's not going to go into this. I assume what he means is the proto-self is awareness itself. The core self is your feelings, the deep self. And the autobiographical self is the thoughts and the history, the story you make for yourself. And there's research at some future point, not now, I will tell you about where these might be located. Well, this, the core self, is probably located in the limbic system to a great extent, in the middle of the brain. The autobiographical self is probably located in the dominant hemisphere of the brain, in the cerebral cortex. Michael Gazzaniga has done work with that. And the core, the proto self is located in the brain stem. Now the question is the brain stem producing the proto self, or is that where you're receiving some larger consciousness and transducing it? The brainstem will be where to look for a universal mind becoming personal mind.
Are shared with many, many other species, and they are really coming up largely of the brainstem and whatever there is of cortex in those species. It's the autobiographical self, which some species have. I think cetaceans and primates have also an autobiographical self to a certain degree, and everybody's dogs at home have an autobiographical self to a certain degree. But the novelty is here. The autobiographical self is built on the basis of past memories and memories about the plans that we have made. It's the lived past and the anticipated future. And the autobiographical self has prompted extended memory, reasoning, imagination, creativity, and language, and out of that came the instruments of culture, religions, justice, trade, the arts, science, technology. And it is within that culture that we really can get, and this is the novelty, something that is not entirely set by our biology. It is developed in the cultures, it is developed in collectives of human beings, and this is, of course, the culture where we have developed something that I like to call sociocultural regulation. And finally, you could rightly ask, why care about this? Why care if it is the brainstem or the cerebral cortex and how this is made? Three reasons. First, curiosity. Primates are extremely curious, and humans most of all. And if we are interested, for example, in the fact that anti-gravity is pulling galaxies away from the Earth, why should we not be interested in what is going on inside of human beings? Second, understanding society and culture. We should look at how society and culture in this sociocultural regulation are a work in progress. And finally, medicine. Let's not forget that some of the worst diseases of humankind are diseases such as depression, Alzheimer's disease, drug addiction. Think of strokes that can devastate your mind or render you unconscious. You have no prayer of understanding how of treating those diseases effectively and in a non-serendipitous way if you do not know how this works. So that's a very good reason beyond curiosity to justify what we're doing and to justify having some interest in what is going on in our brains. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, so that's the didactic part of class. We're going to build on that in the future. Having seen that, I'll refer to it and I'll say, okay, what aspect of our experience are we talking about? What do we know about it neuropsychologically? So we're going to come back to this. It's just, this was school today. But I don't have time for questions right now, maybe in a minute. I actually only have the exact amount of time. I didn't want to leave you with this, with the didactic stuff, because for some people this is kind of heavy. If not, if you want to see this again, by the way, this is a very rich talk, Antonio Damasio. I wanted to leave you with something inspirational, okay? And with something on a very different level. Many of us have learned that as the twig is bent, so grows the tree. That is, that childhood determines who we are. That it's so fundamental what happens in our gestation, our birth, and our early childhood that we have to work within those parameters. We can't escape that. The tyranny of the past has been what it's been called. If you believe that, your ability to grow is somewhat limited and maybe stunted. So the question is, can people make really, really dramatic shifts in who they are? Or are they, can they just make modulate who they started out to be? And you're about to see a 9-minute video about somebody who made a remarkable, dramatic shift. And it gives you hope. So this, some of you may have seen, this is kind of going viral, but it's worth seeing again if you have. Okay, listen to this, just a quick little video here.
On November 5th, 1990, a man named Alcide Moser walked into a hotel in Manhattan and assassinated Rabbi Meir Kahana, the leader of the Jewish Defense League. Moser was initially found not guilty of the murder, but while serving time on lesser charges, he and other men began planning attacks on a dozen New York City landmarks, including tunnels, synagogues, and United Nations headquarters. Thankfully, those plans were foiled by an FBI informant. Sadly, the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center was not. Nocera would eventually be convicted for his involvement in the plot. Alcide Nocera is my father. I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1983 to him, an Egyptian engineer, and a loving American mother and grade school teacher, who together tried their best to create a happy childhood for me. It wasn't until I was 7 years old that our family dynamics started to change. My father exposed me to a side of Islam that few people, including the majority of Muslims, get to see. It's been my experience that when people take the time to interact with one another, it doesn't take long to realize that for the most part, we all want the same things out of life. However, in every religion, in every population, you'll find a small percentage of people who hold so fervently to their beliefs that they feel they must use any means necessary to make others live as they do. A few months prior to his arrest, he sat me down and explained that for the past few weekends, he and some friends had been going to a shooting range on Long Island for target practice. He told me I'd be going with him the next morning. We arrived at the Calvertson shooting range, which, unbeknownst to our group, was being watched by the FBI. When it was my turn to shoot, my father helped me hold the rifle to my shoulder and explained how to aim at the target about 30 yards off. That day, the last bullet I shot hit a small orange light that sat on top of the target, and to everyone's surprise, especially mine, the entire target burst into flames. My uncle turned to the other men and in Arabic said, "Ibn Abu," like father, like son. They all seemed to get a really big laugh out of that comment, but it wasn't until a few years later that I fully understood what they thought was so funny. They thought they saw in me the same destruction my father was capable of. Those men would eventually be convicted of placing a van filled with 1,500 pounds of explosives into the sub-level parking lot of the World Trade Center's North Tower, causing an explosion that killed 6 people and injured over 1,000 others. These were the men I looked up to. These were the men I called Ammu, which means uncle. By the time I turned 19, I had already moved 20 times in my life. And that instability during my childhood didn't really provide an opportunity to make many friends. Each time I began to feel comfortable around someone, it was time to pack up and move to the next town. Being the perpetual new face in class, I was frequently the target of bullies. I kept my identity secret from my classmates to avoid being targeted, but as it turns out, being the quiet, chubby new kid in class was more than enough ammunition. So for the most part, I spent my time at home, reading books and watching TV or playing video games. For those reasons, my social skills were lacking, to say the least. And growing up in a bigoted household, I wasn't prepared for the real world. I'd been raised to judge people based on arbitrary measurements, like a person's race or religion. So what opened my eyes? One of my first experiences that challenged this way of thinking was during the 2000 presidential elections. Through a college prep program, I was able to take part in the National Youth Convention in Philadelphia. My particular group's focus was on youth violence, and having been a victim of bullying for most of my life, this was a subject in which I felt particularly passionate. The members of our group came from many different walks of life. One day, toward the end of the convention, I found out that one of the kids I had befriended was Jewish. Now, it had taken several days for this detail to come to light, and I realized that there was no natural animosity between the two of us. I had never had a Jewish friend before, and frankly, I felt a sense of pride in having been able to overcome a barrier that for most of my life I had been led to believe was insurmountable. Another major turning point came when I found a summer job at Busch Gardens, an amusement park. There I was exposed to people from all sorts of faiths and cultures, and that experience proved to be fundamental to the development of my character. Most of my life I've been taught that homosexuality was a sin, and by extension, that all gay people were a negative influence. As chance would have it, I had the opportunity to work with some of the gay performers at a show there, and soon found that many were the kindest, least judgmental people I had ever met. Being bullied as a kid created a sense of empathy in me toward the suffering of others, and it comes very unnaturally to me to treat people who are kind in any other way than how I would want to be treated. Because of that feeling, I was able to contrast the stereotypes I've been taught as a child with real-life experience and interaction. I don't know what it's like to be gay, but I'm well acquainted with being judged for something that's beyond my control. Then, there was The Daily Show. On a nightly basis, Jon Stewart forced me to be intellectually honest with myself about my own bigotry, and helped me to realize that a person's race, religion, or sexual orientation had nothing to do with the quality of one's character. He was, in many ways, a father figure to me when I was in desperate need of one. Inspiration can often come from an unexpected place, and the fact that a Jewish comedian had done more to positively influence my worldview than my own extremist father is not lost on me. One day I had a conversation with my mother about how my worldview was starting to change, and she said something to me that I will hold dear to my heart for as long as I live. She looked at me with the weary eyes of someone who'd experienced enough dogmatism to last a lifetime and said, "I'm tired of hating people." In that instant, I realized how much negative energy it takes to hold that hatred inside of me. Zaki Rahim is not my real name. I changed it when my family decided to end our connection with my father and start a new life. So why would I out myself and potentially put myself in danger? Well, that's simple. I do it in the hopes that perhaps someone someday who is compelled to use violence may hear my story and realize that there is a better way. That although I have been subjected to this violent, intolerant ideology, that I did not become fanaticized. Instead, I choose to use my experience to fight back against terrorism, against the bigotry. I do it for the victims of terrorism and their loved ones, for the terrible pain and loss that terrorism has forced upon their lives. For the victims of terrorism, I will speak out against these senseless acts and condemn my father's actions. And with that simple fact, I stand here as proof that violence isn't inherent in one's religion or race, and the son does not have to follow the ways of his father. I am not my father. Thank you. Thank you.
Now she can see your shoulders.
Okay. If you have questions or comments about the first video, come up right after we adjourn and I will attempt to answer them. Sorry that I had to cram so much into the time today, but that's going to be the way it is because we don't have a lot of time. I hope that second video resonates with you. I think it's incredibly powerful and hopeful. I will dismiss class. Does anybody have any art right at this today? Okay, so let's dismiss class today. For next week, if you have a poem or something, Abraham, we will do it, okay? So let's dismiss class today. Have a great week, and I'll see you next week.